I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. For some, jazz is an acquired taste. For others, the nuances and improvisation give it a fascinating complexity. Whether you're a casual listener or a jazz head like me, everyone can gain an appreciation if they know how to listen to this original American music form. Today, we'll learn from an expert on the subject. Then, Kansas City has many attractions that bring in visitors, but what does it have to persuade people to live here? We'll find out what makes the KC Metro position for sustainable growth to become genuinely world-class. Later, the weekend to-do list with Brian McTavish. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. Well, this was the song that changed my world back in 1991. I heard this song in my first jazz class at Stanford, and I was dumbfounded. Now, this was something different from all that rock and roll I had absorbed over the years, and something I liked a whole lot. But as we all know, jazz isn't for everybody. In fact, a lot of people struggle with the music and have for years. Today, a primer on jazz from one of its leading scholars. Ted Gioia is a jazz pianist, an award-winning music historian, and author of 10 books, including his latest, The History of Jazz. Today, we're talking about his new book, How to Listen to Jazz. That's the latest book. Ted's making an appearance at 6 this evening at the American Jazz Museum. More on that in a few minutes. And Ted, what a pleasure to have you here. Welcome to Kansas City.
Thank you for having me on.
Well, why don't we just listen to Miles Davis and Kind of Blue this morning and call it a day, because for me, it doesn't get much more complicated than this, Ted.
Well, it's a great entry point into jazz for people, Kind of Blue.
Yeah.
And the way I tell people to listen to it is to forget all the technical analysis, forget all the intellectual content, and approach the musicians the way you would approach people you would meet through their personality.
Yeah.
And when I listen to Kind of Blue, you have those great personalities. And you can tell what these people are like by listening to the way they play, the way they improvise. You can tell that Miles Davis is emotional and moody. You can sense the seriousness and the assertiveness of John Coltrane. You listen to Cannonball Adderley, and you see that stylishness, that flamboyance. You listen to Bill Evans on piano, and you get a sense of how introspective,
yes,
how cerebral he is.
Yes.
And people think, well, jazz is so complex, it's so difficult. But no, just listen to the music. And when you deal with the greatest artists, you understand who they are. You understand their character, their personality. And that is the best entry point into the music.
You know, if you have to learn to love jazz in your new book, and how to listen to it, does that sort of fly in the face of how most people listen to music, which is this sort of visceral reaction to what they've just heard?
Well, there are two levels. I always tell people, never be ashamed of your emotional reaction to music. The emotional reaction is always valid. And sometimes critics will make you ashamed of it. They'll say, oh, you can't like that, or you shouldn't like that. And I say, no. Always hold on to your emotional connection to the music. Now, what I try to do with people in jazz is I build on that. You start with that emotional connection, and then you learn the nuances, the subtleties. And as with any aspect of your life, whether you're learning a sport or you're learning some pastime, you build on that. But that emotional connection always has to be primary. And so I point people in the direction of music like Kind of Blue or the other recordings like that, in which they can immediately grasp that emotional intensity that I think is essential to jazz.
Oh, what is improvisation exactly, Ted? Because what we just listened to in Kind of Blue is a great example of it, because everything I've read about that, the making of that album, and it is the best-selling album in jazz history was that Miles Davis walked into the studio and gave the players just the sketchiest outlines of what they were about to do.
Well, sometimes musicians are given even less. There's a macho attitude in jazz that emphasizes spontaneity, almost to a ridiculous extreme. I had a friend once who was playing in front of 6,000 people with a famous jazz horn player. And he said, Ted, he wouldn't tell us what songs we were going to play until we were on stage.
Really?
Then he would tell us the name and expect that we know it. And I was sharing this story with another musician. He said, oh, Ted, they had it easy. I played once with a famous saxophonist. He wouldn't even tell me the name when we were on stage. He would play a little introduction on the saxophone, and then he would count out the beat with his foot. And I was supposed to figure out from these meager clues what was going to happen.
And people, that sounds like torture to
me. No, well, for the musicians, sometimes it can be.
Yeah.
But I think this is part of the ethos of jazz, but it's also part of the excitement of jazz. I know when I go to a jazz concert, I know I may hear something that night that will never be played again.
Right.
And the musicians are completely in the moment. And when do you find that in any art form?
Yeah.
I mean, art, even art now is so planned. It's almost like architecture. They have the blueprint and they work on it over 5-10 years. But jazz still captures that immediacy of experience. It's one of the things that drew me to the music. And I think it's one of the things that draws other people as well.
To do it well, it takes what?
Well, I think one of the things I just said is being able to exist in the moment. And I think this is one of the reasons why jazz musicians have all these famous lifestyle problems. I don't think it's coincidence that someone is so good at living in the moment is not going to be very good at planning their 401k or their retirement strategy. And this is part of the jazz essence. Is you've got to focus completely on what's happening right then.
And that makes so much sense to me just from talking to the families of great jazz players here in Kansas City who sort of say exactly that their finances are always a mess, but get them on stage and it's a whole different story.
Well, it's a curse and a blessing to be able to do this. It's a curse and a blessing to be able to commit yourself so totally to the demands of the present instant. And I don't think that's just a legend or a myth about jazz. If you meet the great jazz musicians, you find they live that way.
Hey, does it bother you that so many people struggle with the music?
I do, because
it bothers me a little bit. I wish more people liked it.
And I think jazz people bear part of the responsibility for this. They often act as though jazz is a kind of nutritional supplement. It's a vitamin. It's marketed as something that's good for you.
Yeah.
And nobody wants a medical treatment. I mean, I'm reminded when I went to the doctor when I was a kid, and the doctor would show me this big needle. And before he gave me the shot, he gave me all the reasons why this needle was good for me. Well, that's how jazz is marketed. But the way jazz should be shared with people is that it's exciting.
Yeah.
It's enjoyable. There's just the momentum of the jazz band when they're playing at the highest level is an extraordinary thing. And that's the way you bring audiences in, not telling them it's good for them, but telling them how exciting it can be.
Let's listen to some music here, because I want to get you here talking about some of these iconic tunes and helping people sort of decipher them a little bit. Let's begin here with Louis Armstrong back in the late 1920s. Maybe he's the founder of jazz, at least he is to many people. This track is called Wild Man Blues. You know, I think I'm right, Ted. Correct me if I'm wrong, but at the time, Louis Armstrong's playing stuff, this kind of extended solo that people hadn't really heard much of, at least up to this point.
He was almost like an inventor. I don't think anyone added more to the body of American music in the 20th century than Louis Armstrong. And the way I really figured that out once was an experiment I did. Back in my early 20s, I went for 2 weeks And I only listened to jazz recorded before Louis Armstrong.
Huh.
So I listened to all the recordings from 1917, 1918,
wow,
that whole period. And then after 2 weeks of that, I put on the Louis Armstrong albums. And it was almost like going from night to day.
Wow.
All
wow
of a sudden, I could hear all these things he was doing that no one had done before him. And not just in jazz, but even in classical music. You would not find these kinds of syncopated rhythms, these ways of moving across the bar line. Nowadays, we take it for granted. Why do we take it for granted? Because every later musician stole these phrases from Louis Armstrong. So now we hear them and they sound very familiar. They sound very everyday. But Louis invented all of these. You could come up with dozens and dozens of ways of shaping the rhythm of a jazz phrase, and you'd have to say he was the one who invented them. If he could have patented these, if he could have copyrighted these, the Louis Armstrong estate would be bringing in millions and millions of dollars, but he gave it as a gift to all of music.
This came from where in his life? What enabled him to be this creator, this inventor on such a massive scale?
Well, this is one of the great mysteries, because we tend to think that musicians learn from their mentors, and clearly Louis Armstrong did have mentors. The most important was a fellow named Joe King Oliver, who had a band in Chicago, and he hired Louis to play with him in 1923. But Louis soon was much better than his mentor. I mean, within a matter of months, people could see that Louis was just doing things that no one else was doing. And you have to attribute this to his genius. I know that's an overworked term. It's a mysterious term. But he created things out of nothing that have now entered the corpus of American music and truly global music as well.
Okay, let's move on to a different track here. This is, again, one of my favorite tracks, songs ever written. This is Duke Ellington playing Sea Jam Blues. About this is such simple stuff. I mean, it sounds simple. This is not complicated, just very simple beat to begin with, and off you go.
The melody only uses two notes, a C and a G.
Yeah.
This is the exact opposite. This is something, how could you even patent this? I mean, it seems like something that's always been there. But this is the great thing about Duke Ellington, and it's a lesson I think all of us in jazz should learn. When people talk about Duke Ellington now, they mention him alongside symphonic composers.
Yes.
So they'll say he's up there with Charles Ives,
yes,
and Aaron Copland. And I'm sure Ellington would be proud to be mentioned among those names. But Ellington was also the connoisseur of the down and dirty, the raw, the bluesy, and took great pride in taking even the simplest elements and showing how they could make great music. I mean,
yeah,
he was a connoisseur of just bending a note. And he would hire trumpeters in his band, trombone players in his band, just because they had an ability with a mute or an ability to distort the tone. And so with Ellington, you learn that jazz is not all about super sophistication and super complexity. It also is evolving into a music where you can take the simplest ingredient and make it as powerful as possible.
And I found over the years that's exactly what I enjoy most, that simple stuff, small groups as opposed to a big orchestra playing. It's so much more powerful to me somehow.
Well, there's sometimes he'll just hit a single chord, or there'll be a single note in the melody line, and just the way it's articulated is extraordinary. And that's a real eye-opener, because I think many people in the jazz world think that the solution is to make it more complex. Ellington teaches you can make it simpler, but still mysterious. There's a mysterious quality even to his simple music.
I want to move on now to Dizzy Gillespie and Charlie Parker in a track titled Groovin' High. And this gets into the whole notion of Kansas City's contribution to the history of jazz, which is unquestioned, right, Ted?
Absolutely. The sound of jazz today is still shaped by what was happening in Kansas City in the 1930s, the way of articulating the rhythm, the way of phrasing, that four beats to the bar, the shift in jazz from 2-4 music to 4-4 music. It all came out of Kansas City, and it is still alive in jazz music wherever you hear it nowadays.
Wow. Okay, here's Dizzy Gillespie and Charlie Parker. They met here in Kansas City. This track is titled Groovin' High. Charlie Parker was a guy bumming around 18th and Vine, 12th and Vine, and he changes the music, and he did it in part in conjunction with Dizzy Gillespie. This is a partnership, again, that really changed the music, right, Ted?
Well, absolutely. Jazz was different after Charlie Parker. After Armstrong, he was the next innovator that brought new ways of phrasing and new rhythms into the music. But again, in listening to it, I stress to people, don't listen to it to study it. Of course, you can do that. I mean, there's a lot of technical aspects of this music that you could analyze. But you also can enjoy it as almost a kind of daredevil type of performance. The one thing even beginners can hear when they listen to Charlie Parker is he would play faster than anybody else.
Yes.
Or when he would play slow, he would take the tempo slower than anybody else. And he would be pushing the music to new extremes. And even without understanding the nuances of it, you listen to the four-bar break he takes on Night in Tunisia or the song's Coco. It's almost like that kind of visceral energy people hear from rock and roll when people like Jimi Hendrix came out. I said, enjoy the music for the emotional intensity. On top of that, you can build the analysis, but don't feel you need to have a PhD to appreciate what Charlie Parker did, because it's still that great rhythmic momentum of jazz and that great appeal that came from Kansas City. I just like to make one more point here.
Yeah.
Kansas City allowed jazz to become mainstream music. Huh. In the late 1930s, jazz became the popular music in America. They call it the swing era. And I don't think it's coincidence this all happened after a lot of Kansas City musicians moved to New York and changed the rhythmic flow of jazz to make it a little smoother, a little more graceful, still with all the momentum and propulsion. But they took that sound, they gave it to the rest of America, and as a result, it became popular music.
That's so interesting.
It still has that appeal today.
You know, one of the great mysteries to me about someone like Charlie Parker has always been that, you know, he's playing around town, he's not really knocking anybody out. Then he goes down to the Ozarks, and Chuck Haddix from KCUR talks about this all the time. He goes down to the Ozarks to play for a summer, and something happens down there. He comes back here, and suddenly he's a different musician, and he's taking off in a way that no one expected him to.
You know, jazz musicians call this woodshedding.
Yeah.
And you go off to the woodshed and you practice where no one can hear you. And then you come back and you're a great musician. And there are two great stories in American music about it. One is about Robert Johnson, the blues musician.
There you go.
Who disappeared for a few months, and he was lousy before he disappeared, and they laughed him off the stage. And when he came back, he was the greatest blues guitarist in the world. So people said he must have sold his soul to the devil. It's the story. But the other great example is Charlie Parker. And this has become perhaps the most famous legend in modern jazz, where Charlie Parker tries to play at a jam session. He is laughed off the stage.
Yes.
He is laughed off the stage. And then he disappears. And for about 6 months, he practices. And he comes back. And he's just blowing people away. And it's a beautiful story, but it's also an inspiring story about what hard work can do. Now, obviously, he had that raw brilliance, that genius. But also, there was that period where he dedicated himself. And probably in those 6 months, he learned what other musicians might take 10 years to learn.
Ted, let's do one last one really quickly here. This is Thelonious Monk. This is a track off Brilliant Corners, his album. You know, you hear Thelonious Monk, and the word that flashes into your mind is idiosyncratic. He's able to piece together these songs with all these off, weird chords, minor keys, and all this stuff, and it works for some reason.
Well, this song is tricky, but it was also tricky for the musicians who played it.
Oh, I'm sure.
There's a story behind this particular recording. I think they had to do 10, 15, 20 takes before the musicians could actually figure out how to play the melody.
I'm not surprised.
And it's very clever the way he does it. The first time through, they play the melody slowly, and it just sounds strange and quirky. And then they go through it at a double tempo, and now it sounds like an obstacle course. But you've got to appreciate Monk once again for his personality and the humor. I think there's a certain humorous element to this. He might even have been playing a bit of a joke on the musicians there. and you can't separate that out from Monk. And once again, you can analyze it. But I think Monk is a classic example of the thing I like to emphasize. Use this music as a way of entering into a relationship with the personality of the jazz musician. Because that's the essence of jazz. When they get to the highest level, the musician puts their personality into the music. And sure, you can analyze it, you can go to school and study it, but you can also enjoy it for that kind of entry point into an amazing musician and person, Thelonious Monk.
Ted Joya's latest book, How to Listen to Jazz, you can see and hear him this evening at the American Jazz Museum over in 18th and Vine as part of the museum's Riffing on the Repertoire speaker series. He speaks tonight at 6 o'clock. The event is free. Visit AmericanJazzMuseum.org. For more information, that's 6 o'clock this evening. Ted, I wish we had more time. I really enjoyed having you. Thanks so much.
Thank you very much.
Time for a break. When we come back, we'll talk about how Kansas City can continue and become a genuinely world-class city. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And we are back. I'm Steve Kraske. On yesterday's program, we looked at Uber's plans to go from the streets to the sky. And we talked with Robert Kaplan on foreign affairs in Syria. You can find those conversations at kcur.org/uptodate. Tomorrow on the show, NASA astronaut Scott Kelly spent over a year in space. On tomorrow's program, our conversation about the experiences of a lifetime. Well, according to Visit KC, the metro area hosts 24 million visitors each year. Whether for business or pleasure, there's a lot to attract people to spend some time in Kansas City. But what would draw people to live here? A lot, according to our next guest. Wendell Cox is principal of Demographia, that's involved in urban public policy and demographic analysis. He'll be speaking at the Kansas City Public Library this evening. We'll have more on that in just a few minutes. But first, Wendell, welcome to Up to Date. So nice to have you here.
Pleased to be here.
When you appraise a city, are you looking at what lies within its boundaries only, or do you consider the greater metropolitan area?
I always look at the metropolitan area because that really is the sort of the competitive entity, right?
Do you look at what is there currently, or do you include potential as well?
Well, I like to focus on outputs. In other words, how are the people living? What are their lives like? And so on. I think there is a real problem with focusing on the built environment and on what is there in terms of infrastructure and so on. How well do the people live and how much do they have left over after they've paid all their bills?
What are you trying to find out? What's the objective here?
I think the objective, I mean, my view, first of all, going back a little bit further, is that I think the top priority of domestic government is to help improve the standard of living and reduce poverty. A city that does that is, I think, fulfilling its need. And so what we're talking about in terms of cities is, one, housing should be inexpensive, generally speaking, and that will be very much important in terms of having a low cost of living. That really is the major objective there. And poverty should be low. And if you've got a city that is pursuing those kinds of objectives successfully, you have a successful city.
Let's look then, Wendell, at Kansas City. Anyone looking to move here would be interested in housing. How do we rate on that metric?
Okay. Well, you know, every year The Economist and Mercer and others do top cities in the world for livability. And usually the top are places like Vancouver and Melbourne and so on. Places, by the way, that most of your listeners couldn't possibly afford to live in.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact is, Kansas City, if you look at The Economist's top 10 cities, Kansas City is more affordable than every single one of them. In fact, number two And I use a price-to-income ratio because I do with a co-author in New Zealand an international housing affordability survey that covers 350 cities every year. If you look at the second best city after Kansas City, it's Calgary, and its costs relative to income for housing are about 40% above Kansas City. So
we're number one?
You're number one. Now, there are other cities that are a little bit better. There are a number of American cities, largely in the Midwest and South, that are similar. But the point is, there is none of the top 10 livable cities that can compete with Kansas City on housing affordability.
And you're talking about single-family housing?
That's
here?
Right.
Is that what you're driving at?
Yeah.
Why are we so low?
It has to do with the fact that you have not had your officials delve into strong land use regulation that draws lines around cities, like has happened in Portland and London and Sydney. And, you know, just as when OPEC decides they're going to cut back on oil, prices go up. When you cut back on the land supply, you force prices up. So that what we have is a situation.
In other words, if you stop sprawl.
That's right. That's mm-hmm. right. And the point is, and everybody loves to think that sprawl is terrible. I would suggest to you that sprawl's not nearly as bad as poverty. And having a good standard of living is an awful lot more important than sprawl. And I'm not suggesting we ought to sprawl on purpose, but the point is, what is the purpose? The purpose is better lives for people. And in cities that allow peripheral expansion, the standard of living is much better.
We're visiting with Wendell Cox. He's a principal with Demographia about what it takes to make a world-class city and how Kansas City fits in all that. I know transportation is a big issue for you as well, and public transportation has been a hot-button one here for the ages. You were appointed to 3 terms on the Los Angeles County Transportation Commission. What did you come away with from that experience?
Well, first of all, and I have to apologize to the voters of Los Angeles for this, but I was the author of the amendment that created the Los Angeles rail system in 1980, okay?
Why apologize to them?
Apologize because we have now in Los Angeles spent $18 billion opening new rail lines, and our transit ridership is less than it was before we started.
No kidding.
And that is with the county having gone from 8 to 10 million people.
Why is that?
It's because transit, and listen, transit is important. When you talk about New York and working in Manhattan, transit makes all the sense in the world. However, in most of suburban New York, it doesn't make that much sense. So when you think...
I can't imagine it doesn't make any sense.
Well, what are you going to do if you can't walk to the line and get to where you're working? I mean, on average, transit takes nearly twice as long for any trip. So for any of your disappointed people in Kansas City about the recent light rail loss, who is going to get out of their car and take twice as long to get to work or where they're going? Nobody's done it anywhere. You go to Portland. Everybody in transit and everybody in urban planning loves Portland. Yet Portland carried 8% of its workers to work on transit before their rail line, before they built their rail system. Now they carry 7%. In Denver, they're down. And in Los Angeles, they're down as well. So the basic problem is that transit cannot possibly serve the city with its dispersion of employment. And you think about Kansas City here, where, you know, about 5% or even less of the employment in the Kansas City metropolitan area is located downtown. And there's a good reason to have good transit to downtown. However, you can't possibly serve the 95% of jobs that are dispersed all over the area. And indeed, some of the projections are suggesting that by 2040, Johnson County may have more jobs than Jackson County.
That's interesting. But what about northeast part of this country? Their mass transit makes more sense or not?
Oh yeah. We like to refer to them as the 6 legacy cities. They would be New York, Chicago, Philadelphia, San Francisco, Washington, and Boston. These are places where up to 30% of the workers use transit to get to work. But by the way, 55% of all the people who commute by transit in the entire United States go to work in only 6 municipalities, not the suburbs, those 6 cities.
And you lost me there. Say that to me
okay,
again.
55% of the people who go to work on transit
right.
have their work destination in only 6 cities.
Okay.
And I'm
okay.
not talking about metropolitan areas.
Mm-hmm.
That's because transit is about downtown. You look, for example, at New York. The New York metropolitan area is something like 30-32% of the workers go to work by transit. If you go outside the core of New York, you get down to around 5%, which is about the national average.
Yeah.
So the problem is transit cannot possibly get you to work. For example, there's been great work at the University of Minnesota that basically said, let's look at how many jobs in a metropolitan area the average person can get to in 30 minutes. The average is 2%. Cars, it's something like 60 or 65%. So this isn't because I love cars. It's because the ability to get around to jobs and have a good labor market is crucial to the economic growth of a city.
Wendell Cox will be speaking this evening at the Kansas City, Missouri Public Library, the Plaza Branch. Things kick off at 6. He'll speak at 6:30. He'll be talking about Kansas City, genuinely world-class. You can reserve a seat at kclibrary.org. So what would you recommend, Wendell, for a city like Kansas City when it comes to mass transit? What's the appropriate path forward then?
Well, the point is, I wouldn't make any recommendation on that. You have, by the way, and I didn't mention this, you ranked with Richmond, Virginia, as the best city for traffic congestion in the world out of 150 by the TomTom Traffic Congestion Index.
That's amazing.
And the point is, that means people can get around. You have a short work trip travel time. What's the point of transit if it's slower than cars? The point is, transit is important for some areas, but you're not going to serve most of the city. So I would say the key is for you to continue to do the kinds of things that have made this city so effective in transportation: a wonderful virtual grid system of freeways, a great arterial street system. You have much to be proud of. And by the way, these two things, housing affordability and traffic congestion, which means you spend less time in your car, are exactly the kinds of things you need to compete against the Californians of the world that are in the process of driving people out with congestion and high housing prices.
I want to go back to sprawl because in your 2012 paper, Toward More Prosperous Cities, you wrote that you're not opposed to spatial urban expansion, or sprawl, more commonly known as sprawl. And again, why not on that, Wendell?
Well, because it's not as important as the standard of living and poverty. Okay?
Yeah.
In other words, you go to places like California, which now has the highest housing cost adjusted poverty rate in the nation, higher than Mississippi. Okay? When you go and create a situation where housing triples in costs relative to income, and that's what you've got in San Francisco or Los Angeles at this point, all of a sudden you drive all sorts of low-income people and middle-income people out of the housing market. This means a lower standard of living. This is a real problem. My view is we should not be focusing on places and the urban form. We should be focusing on people.
Hmm. And so sprawl then has its merits then.
Oh, you're absolutely.
Suggesting. Yeah.
I mean, I'm not an advocate of sprawl.
Why does it have such a bad rap?
Because
then?
You have a planning community that has in their mind a particular form of the city. We should be focusing on affluence. We should be focusing on the good of people and how they live, not what our cities look like.
Okay. Do you consider the ability to expand outward crucial to a city's growth? It sounds like you're saying the answer to that is...
There is absolutely no question. There are those who believe, for example, that you can go to San Francisco and build buildings to the sky and you're going to improve housing affordability. Not a chance. The problem with housing affordability is the price of land, and that's driven by the cost of land on the periphery. And what happens when you put out these kind of boundaries and you don't permit peripheral development, land prices are pushed up. And in fact, there one school of thought, the market urbanists, love to talk about intensification or densification as the answer for improving housing affordability in San Francisco. It has never happened anywhere.
So when you talk to city officials, even the city officials in Kansas City, Missouri, they all bemoan sprawl. Are they open to your message?
Well, a lot of them are, yes, especially in the suburbs. But one of the problems is that you have an urban planning community that is lockstep in an almost ideological or theoretical, or excuse me, theological opposition to urban expansion. It's not like we're running out of land. And you know, it's just amazing to me that the priority of putting people first has been put to the back burner because we want to have a particular look to our cities.
Can a city be sustainable with what you call densification, often referred to as smart growth, Wendell?
Well, it depends upon what you think about what you call sustainable. If it means real people can live there, no. Go to Vancouver, where middle-income people are being driven out by house prices that are just escalating like you can't believe. Or San Francisco. There is no room in San Francisco or Los Angeles or Portland or Seattle for middle-income and lower-income people. And the only ones of those that will remain in the long run are the ones that have been fortunate enough to buy their houses before the appreciation began.
But still, there's a notion that a lot of people want to live closer to where they work.
Well,
and that's an argument against sprawl.
No, not at all. Because, in fact, where there is more sprawl, to use your term, or more spatial dispersion, travel times are less to work. Why? Because sprawl and higher density increases traffic congestion and slows down travel. We've done research that's been published by the Singapore Land Transport Authority that basically shows that sprawl is related to longer work trip travel times. So it may be nice to be able to say, well, I live closer to work, but if it's taking you longer, you've gained nothing by it.
Well, Wendell, let's wrap this up. What can the Kansas City area do to help ensure its growth and to remain world class?
The key is to recognize that your competitors on the West Coast and the Northeast are shooting themselves in the foot. Therefore, you must continue the kinds of policies you've had, which involve making sure traffic congestion is okay and not imposing land use restrictions that raise prices. I see in the long run a good chance that much of the kind of movement of people that's gone to Texas, and believe it or not, is now going to Oklahoma from places like California in the Northeast, will happen here because this is a great place to live when your choice is living in a walk-up apartment in San Francisco or in a nice house, in Clay County in Kansas City.
Wendell Cox presents Kansas City Genuinely World Class this evening at the Plaza Branch of the Kansas City, Missouri Public Library. It'll be at 6:30. You can reserve a seat at kclibrary.org. Wendell, thanks so much. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Coming up, Brian McTavish and your weekend to-do list.
It's very clear. Love is here to stay. Not for you, my dear, forever and a day. Telephone and the movies we used to know. We're just a passing fancy. In time we'll show. But
Brian McTavish is here to talk about cool stuff to do this weekend. And how are you, buddy? Welcome.
How about
Bobby Watson and Ernie Andrews, the great Ernie Andrews, right?
You're a fan of Bobby.
I am a huge fan of Bobby. He wrote the theme music to our show.
Beautiful
so
music.
I have a great affinity for Bobby Watson. Yeah.
Let it swing. Let it swing this weekend when Bobby Watson,
You're just pulling yourself together here. You're just you're just going 15 different directions at once. You know,
it's crazy.
Just take a deep breath, and we're gonna get through this. You know,
yeah.
Here you go,
Bobby Watson.
Yeah,
the great Bobby Watson. Let it swing 8 o'clock Saturday night at the Gem Theater.
It's a good thing.
It is a good thing. Tell me about Bobby.
Well, I love Bobby Watson just because he's like Kansas City's premier jazz performer who's been here like forever, and he's the man. I actually sat and watched him record our theme music one day, which was one of my singular thrills of the last 5 years. It was just great. So, yeah.
And you know who he's going to be playing with?
Ernie Andrews.
Ernie Andrews.
Yeah.
Who's managed to be both popular and underrated.
Yes, for many years.
Absolutely. He is going to... please excuse me.
Yeah, you're just... You had a race out of the parking lot because you were just... You're having one of those life-changing experiences because you weren't like the. It's one of my great nightmares. The show starts and you're not here to be there with it.
Well, there's a first time for everything.
There's a first, and you're here.
Yeah. I am here.
Yeah.
So anyway, as far as Bobby Watson goes, I love the new theme music.
Yeah.
He's going to be performing with Ernie Andrews.
That's the right answer. Loving the new theme
at
music,
8 o'clock.
Which I do.
Right.
Yeah.
At 8 o'clock on Saturday night. This is what happens when you forget your keys and put them in the wrong place.
Oh.
And now here we are.
And this is what you do. Yeah.
This is what we do. That's right.
Yeah.
My apologies. In any event.
Yes, and there's going to be an event on Saturday night.
8 o'clock Saturday night. Bobby Watson conducts the American Jazz Orchestra with vocalist Ernie Andrews. At 8 o'clock Saturday at the Gym Theater.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, right?
Okay, we'll be there.
I am the god of hellfire, and I bring you fire.
All right, who was that guy?
Who was that guy? I don't know who that
We're
guy
back.
Was. I don't know who that was.
Okay, Pompeii. You remember the lost city of Pompeii, do you not?
I do.
They're having a wonderful exhibition with special effects and artifacts. And they're going to relive the terrible eruption of Mount Vesuvius in 79 A.D.
I wasn't there.
Yeah, you were.
Yeah.
I think I was there, frankly.
Yeah.
And they're going to rediscover all those wonderful things that we have now, which were wonderful before they were covered in ash. The exhibit opens at Union Station. Yeah, not for them. It's from 10 to 7 on Friday and Saturday and 11 to 5 on Sunday at Union Station. What's most chilling, perhaps, other than my performance today, is they're going to have a half dozen plaster casts of people who didn't make it. They didn't make it.
Yeah.
I'm not making it.
Yes, but you are making it now. You're slowly.
Oh, we're getting there.
And every week now in the future, you'll be putting your keys out by the door so you can find them readily the next morning.
Well, if you have me back.
You'll be back.
If you have me back.
We're going to get through this.
No, well, you know, it's a special treat for all the listeners.
This is called live radio,
oh,
buddy.
Oh, no, it's not called that. I think it's going to be called something else in about 10 minutes when we all get together and have a chat.
Okay.
But anyway, Union Station has done a wonderful job of having these fantastic exhibits over the years, and this is the latest. They do tend to be grim sometimes, and they're going to have like a special 4D sense-around sound theater of some sort, which will replicate the awfulness of the end of those poor people's lives.
See,
in 79
to me, you're always a model of composure, and this is this is a lot.
No.
Okay, be sure to see Brian's six ferocious things to do in Kansas City this weekend.
Definitely.
Just go to kcur.org.
Do what he says. Yeah.
What do we have here?
Well, that's a pertinent question.
The Illusionist.
What do we have here?
I've never seen this before.
Oh.
I don't know what we have here.
Well, you only live once.
I used to know you. Yeah.
Oh, no, you know me just fine.
You'll remember this day for years to come.
Oh, no, I won't. No, it's out of my head already. Trust me. There's no doubt about that. Anyway, we have The Illusionists live from Broadway. acts of levitation, mind reading, disappearance, and what they call a first time full view water torture escape.
Wow.
Like Houdini, wow. Holy Houdini.
Oh, man.
Shows are all this week at the Music Hall.
I love stuff like this, by the way. Love it.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I do.
What's your favorite illusion?
I went and saw the Great Blackstone in Minneapolis on New Year's Eve back like in 1980. It was thrilling. I like this stuff. Yeah.
Huh.
You know.
Well, my favorite illusion is this water torture escape. I saw it in an old biopic of Harry Houdini. I think Tony Curtis played the great Houdini.
Oh, yeah, sure.
But there was a trick to it where there was a back door. Here they're going to show us the whole thing.
That's cool.
This glass around the water, and he's chained, and hopefully he'll get out of it. You know, I think it's
you
nice.
You don't know? You assume he will?
I'm a big believer in people trying to get out of jams if they can at this stage.
But he told us where we stand.
And this is the Rocky Horror Show.
Well, yes, the Rocky Horror Show as opposed to the Rocky Horror Picture Show.
Right.
The movie came out in 75. It was based on the stage play, the Rocky Horror Show, which debuted in 1973. It's the classic weirdo audience participation sci-fi horror musical. It's on stage tonight at 8 o'clock every night through Sunday at Prohibition Hall, that beautiful hall built in the early 1900s, about 11th and McGee, downtown. And you are encouraged to come in costume, emulating your favorite crazy character from Rocky Horror. Do not bring props. No props allowed. They will, conveniently enough, sell props at the door, so have fun waving those around.
And finally today...
Mm-hmm.
This is Kitten.
Oh, yeah, meow.
A group named Kitten?
Indie rock from... Yeah, well, she's a kitten. I mean, she's a self-proclaimed kitten. Basically, she's the star of the show, and I'm referring to Chloe Chaidez?
Yes.
Let's just call her Chloe, shall we?
They're in town this weekend.
They're in town Saturday night, 8 o'clock, at the Record Bar. This is a gal who... the name Kitten doesn't really do justice to the ferociousness of this melodic onslaught. Chloe started her own band at age 10 in L.A., so she's pretty wild now.
That's Brian McTavish and your weekend to-do list. Thanks, buddy.
Was it Brian McTavish?
It was. Tomorrow on the show, our conversation with astronaut Scott Kelly about his career, including a year in space. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.